Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
So today for Goals Question Time, I've got the pleasure of being joined by David Browning, who is CEO of Oxford Cancer Biomarkers. Hi, David.
Hi, Andrew.
Very good you could join us. We've known each other for many years from when you were at Philips and then MediCity. So great you could join us. And please give us a brief introduction to yourself, please.
Well, thank you. So I guess I've been in the healthcare field for some 37 years now. So I started out in health service as a biochemist, trained on the job, and then went into industry. So first with Amersham, and ultimately work with larger companies in innovation like J&J and more recently Philips. And I've also supported and led startups through my role in MediCity, but also leading spin-outs from in the past from Oxford University and out in California. And having worked with a number of startups and speed-ups over the last few years, I felt it was a good time to get back into a role where I was really leading from the front and taking some exciting innovation and trying to make a difference in improving standards of care, in this case with Oxford Cancer Biomarkers in cancer. And I do retain an ambassador role with MediCity, BioCity, so I'm still involved in networking, part of MediCity's raison d'etre is to look out for interesting and exciting disruptive pipeline opportunities for our partners, Walgreens Boots Alliance. So I'm still sort of networking and supporting that that group as well.
Yeah, and that's a great initiative you had up there. I've visited and spoke a number of times there at I'd say that Boots sort of campus, or formerly Boots campus. So could you describe a bit more now about Oxford Cancer Biomarkers, please?
I will, and I'll abbreviate perhaps to OCB at times as well, Andrew. So OCB's been around for about 6 years now, and really was founded on the work of Professor David Kerr and Professor Nick Lathang from Oxford University Hospitals. So they're professors of cancer medicine and biology, and they were aware of some of the gaps and challenges in cancer care, particularly in, first of all, optimizing or trying to optimize the treatment for the individual and look at avoiding adverse side effects, but also ultimately getting to a point where we can move from reactive approaches to cancer to proactive. And I'm sure you and the listeners are aware of some of the stats around cancer at the moment, and it's a problem like several diseases that are significantly associated with lifestyle, consequently are becoming more of a burden, not just here in the UK, but all around the world. And certainly earlier diagnosis and intervention is important. And ideally, if you can get in there before the disease manifests itself, then even better. So the work that the team embarked on and start with, they started working with Quintiles and AstraZeneca and some of the big pharma companies, was really around a companion diagnostic approach. So the team developed their own in-house tools using gene silencing to identify which genes might be associated with certain outcomes in terms of response to treatment or treatment selection. And as they advanced with that, there was a recognition that there was an opportunity to actually to go directly to market, not to necessarily be held up by the very long timelines that you see with a therapeutic, and obviously a diagnostic that's associated with a therapeutic will be subject to the same timelines, which can be quite protracted. So the idea was to get out there and start bringing this technology to market more quickly. And specifically, there are two platforms. One is based on looking at genes and understanding which genes are associated with risk of cancer. So our slightly longer-term product, we will be a screening product, first of all, for colon cancer, so identifying those individuals who have a higher genetic risk of developing the disease and where lifestyle choices will be all the more important. So the idea is that you would do a screen at a relatively young age, ultimately, and then provide that specific advice to the individual where having a more regular, in the case of colon cancer, more regular colonoscopy would be relevant, but also helping guide them to make the right lifestyle choices. And one big insight that I've validated all around the world over the years is it's not, and it's just for other diseases beyond cancer, it's not good enough to say to somebody, you know, you are at higher risk of cancer or diabetes, so you need to think about your lifestyle. People react badly to that. You know, don't tell me I've got a problem because it just makes it worse. I'm going to be more stressed, and I know stress is an issue. So It's important to be able to provide that personalised support. So we're looking at new routes to market. I might go into that a little bit later on.
Yes.
So that's our first point. And we're also using the same technology to look at how an individual will metabolise drugs that are commonly used as chemotherapy agents for cancer. And I guess we all know that chemotherapy, whilst it can be effective, has its downsides. In some individuals, they exhibit very toxic events, and in a few cases, it can even prove to be fatal. So our technology looks at how an individual will metabolize a cancer drug, specifically from the person's genome, and can provide advice to the oncologist, so the cancer doctors, with regards to whether to prescribe a particular generic, whether to dose modulate, so to provide a lower dose, whether there's a risk of adverse events like hand and foot syndrome, which can be prevented or minimized in terms of impact if it's known that there's a risk. So that's our main focus. And then our second platform, which we have just launched in China last week, looks at the DNA of the cancer. So we use digital pathology tools to actually look at the cancer DNA and understand how aggressive it is, how it's likely to react to treatment. So again, that will guide the care pathway. So we're looking to bring those products forward, first in colon cancer, and expand them out into a whole range of different cancers, and also to look at bringing in other platforms that might complement our in-house capabilities.
Okay, and the size of the team and funding you've had so far?
Well, we're pretty small as a team, so there's around 8 of us full-time in the organisation. But it's important to say, and I'll come on to this later, that we do collaborate both with academic partners and also partners that can help us with the front end, so the actual sort of sample analysis. Our real expertise is identifying the biomarkers and then applying the artificial intelligence, the AI, to make sense of the data. So in terms of the number of people working with us, that will be some tens of people.
Yeah.
In terms of funding, we've enjoyed some funding, first of all, spin out from Oxford University, from Oxford Innovation, but also from venture capitalists and partners in Asia. So we've had around, $3.5 million of investment. But going forward, our focus now is on developing revenue so that we can attract more investment to grow rather than to survive.
Okay, so good. So as we said, you've had previous experience in large corporates and incubators. Can you contrast the ways you're working now with those sort of types of larger organisations?
There's a lot of similarities, actually, because, interestingly, if we take my role in Philips, for example, which was in innovation, although you would think of Philips as being a big global organisation, which it is, when you get down to the specifics of looking to bring in a new platform, then that would be treated as a venture. So I guess it's very much like a venture funded and led business. So our backers might be predominantly internal, so Philips might be funding it, but in terms of how we work in a very agile way, then there aren't so many dissimilarities to being in a small, nimble startup organization. Having said that, there are some key differences, and one big one, I guess, is the internal stakeholder management that is so important in a big organization like Philips or J&J, making sure that you've got the support and sponsorship from board level right through to other parts of the organization, whether that be for market access or just for sort of human resources and other support. So there is a somewhat almost seemingly disproportionate amount of time spent on what I would call internal stakeholder management. And I guess we do the same thing in startups, that they're, you know, we're looking at our funders and our partners, you know, more globally and outside the organization as well. I guess the other thing is just being aware of the direction of the company, and that can be difficult to be autonomous where a change in direction at board level or strategic level in, say, a Philips or a J&J could completely obviate the initiative that you're trying to lead. So again, that comes back to not just stakeholder management, but trying to anticipate the direction of what is, you know, a very significant size of organisation.
Mm-hmm. Good. Now, you know, I've outlined what I term innovative new value chains, about how we connect new technologies and startups and corporates with new business models. And I think, you know, OCB is a good example, as you've talked about partly already, around the personalised pathways and changing people's lifestyles. That's more than just telling somebody they've got a problem and giving a tablet or sort of something like that. Could you explain a bit more, please, about this, how you see connecting these new technologies and how the business model is going to change in health and cancer care?
Yeah, absolutely. So being pragmatic, our first products, as I mentioned, are being sold to the healthcare professionals, so to the oncologists, and we're aspiring to improve outcomes where a patient already has cancer. But you're right, to your point, the real need and opportunity going forward, given the burden of cost of treating people with disease and comorbidities where they may have survived a first cancer but be at risk of another cancer, they may have diabetes or heart disease, this burden of cost is going to become completely unwieldy. But also, people's expectations are very different now. So as people are living into longer age, I think a factor that will become increasingly important is disability-free life years. So living for longer, but living with a decent quality of life. And this is going to become a bigger burden. Some of the listeners may have heard, I've been listening from the UK, there was a statement put out by Cancer Research UK last week, which indicated that some 70% of millennials, so those born in, I guess, the 80s and 90s, will be obese in their mid-20s, mid-30s. And mm-hmm. It was interesting that Cancer Research UK put this out, because they weren't coming at it from the point of view of, you know, obesity per se and heart disease and diabetes, which is the things people often think about, but really around the greater risk of cancer. And that mm-hmm. point in itself, I think, highlights my earlier observations around lifestyle being very important. So when we think about colon cancer, we would say that genetic predisposition is about a third of it, and then two-thirds is lifestyle. So from that point of view, how do we engage with the individual that would benefit from support? And that support might be more regular screening, which might be somewhat invasive. So colonoscopies are not something that people would, I guess, sign up for unless... But also the lifestyle, you know, making choices. It might seem obvious to say to somebody, look, you've got a high risk for cancer, you need to definitely stop smoking and really think about your diet and exercise. And we know that just doesn't resonate. You know, it's got to be personalised and tailored to the individual. And also, it's very difficult for, if you take the UK, for governments to initiate screening programmes that will provide benefits in terms of better outcomes from perhaps 10, 20, even 30 or 40 years in the future. So mm-hmm. there are other market access points and organisations that are going to be important. So we're looking at partnering with insurance, with employee wellbeing schemes, with partners that have started to validate some very interesting apps and behaviour change models which support people to become more motivated to think about the health of themselves and their families.
Yeah.
And so it's going to take you know, a number of different groups coming together. Walgreens Boots Pharmacy are very interested in how to do online pharmacy, but also in the high street. They may be able to use their brand and knowledge and connection and trust from the point of view of the pharmacist to help with these sort of initiatives. So it's going to take a collective. And also then the other part is the management of what is highly complex data. So it's one thing to say to somebody, look, you know, we know that there's an interaction, your metabolism is affected by your activity or lack of it in the day, your screen time, so whether you're exposed to blue light in the evening, all of these go into a cycle which can start to become quite a downward spiral. So in terms of how we engage with people, providing that succinct personalized information about their activity, their specific nutrition, their sleep and so forth, doing so in a way that's intuitive and easy to understand, takes a lot of processing power. And so we're also looking to partner with organizations that have got advanced cloud-based computing capabilities. And some of those might be some of the bigger names that have been around for a while in the field, and others will be disruptive organizations like ourselves who are coming in with advanced AI capabilities.
I agree that joining up the different sort of diagnostics, the different therapies and changing behaviors sort of so important. And like within my book, Purpose to Performance, I outlined the example from Merck where they'd invested in a, you know, cardiac monitoring, a secure data in the cloud, artificial intelligence, and changing the sort of way that the patient is cared for in the home rather than in the hospital. So I think, you know, you're very much within that new value chain, which is going to change the business model and types of technologies that organizations are going to use. So are you finding good cases?
Sorry, I was going to say I agree. And just to say further, we're looking at it even broader. So we're talking to, for example, the National Innovation Centre for Ageing up in Newcastle, where they will go further and look at urban design and transport and homes and so forth, both from a sustainability point of view, but also from the point of view of these value chains as they pervade into people's wider lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
So, I think we're well placed in the UK. There's some really exciting initiatives going back to Boots. The Boots campus in Nottingham is being developed into effectively a well-being environment, I guess. It's an enterprise zone, but the aspiration is to build homes and communities that will be exemplars for some of these new approaches. And I know of other examples that are in the work. So it's going to be really interesting. And again, collaboration across different points of industry are going to be crucial. So whereas when I was a biochemist, we would talk to other biochemists and validate our ideas, now the model has got to be much broader. And that really, I think, fits with your value chains model as well, Andrew.
Yeah, and the global corporates or organizations that need to think globally, I think, is going to be so important, because these things are bringing technologies from different locations, changing, and getting into health or getting into automotive or getting into city designs and all that are going to need grown-up organizations and grown-up processes. So taking this a little bit further out in terms of illustrating, you know, a couple of examples, I particularly saw your initiative in China recently, and where you were doing multi-locations and engaging with Chinese organizations. It'd be great if you can give us some insights into that, please.
No, absolutely. So we're partnering with my Biomed, NBM in China, who are experts in molecular biology. So rather than just go out there and find a distributor, we've partnered with an organization that has got complementary capabilities to ourselves. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is because they've got a strong and comprehensive knowledge of the Chinese market. And interestingly, when they were looking at which area to select first, for their focus, because they've got broad capabilities, they decided to go for cancer. The reason being if you take, and I guess we all know China is a vast country with a very big population, if you take cardiovascular disease, to reach 70% of the population, you would need to interact with 3,000 hospitals, which is really surprising. However, because there is a more consolidated model for oncology and people will travel to the best centres to get treatment, and again, the informed patient is going to be more and more significant. So we're seeing, countries like China where this is happening already. So people will go to the best place, and that might even be a health tourism where they might say, okay, for my resection, so to get the cancer removed, I might go to South Korea because they're best in this, and then I'll go back to China for my chemotherapy or longer-term care. So for cancer, you can reach 70% of the population with just 100 hospitals. So that's really quite interesting. And so MBM also have expertise, as I mentioned, in genomics. And I guess we all know that there are genetic variances or variations between populations. Some of those are obvious in terms of how we look, skin color, and so forth. But others are more subtle. It may be the way in which we process a particular cancer drug. So MBM are working with us to extend the genes that we look at to make sure that we've got the repertoire that are important for the Chinese population covered within our products. And so there's a couple of things there, but in terms of the launch, that was really exciting. So we worked with them and hosted a six-center video conference, four centers in China, two in the UK, 180 delegates in China, many of them key opinion leaders. And what was really exciting was it was a very dynamic forum with experts here in the UK talking about the seminal paper, which was the basis for our first platform that we've launched in China. But then interactive, some then presentations from experts in China who've been validating our work, and then interactive questions and answers, and a real sort of sense of being joined up. And I think that for me was really exciting and shows that you don't have to get too hung up about distance and geographical boundaries. And in fact, one of the advantages of working in China first is that they're not burdened by the same infrastructure. One of the great things about the UK, for example, is that we've got a well-established health service, but that can also be a challenge in bringing new technology to market and scaling it up quickly. So, whilst we've got a central national health service, as I guess many listeners will know who are aware of the UK market, it's still necessary to have individual conversations with different hospital trusts and different bodies that might be supporting the translation of innovation into health.
So yeah, I've certainly found that working with a number of corporates, they've seen China as being a place to where they could do things at speed and scale in these types of areas and that as well. And particularly when we go back to the innovative new value chain and thinking about connecting new technologies and bringing those things together, the Chinese market seems to be more open to that at the moment to be able to do those. And you have some examples in the UK?
So going forward in the UK, we're just getting started, but in terms of collaboration there, our model is to really focus on the bit that we do well, which is discovery of the new biomarkers and then the artificial intelligence. So we're collaborating with partners in Nottingham, first of all, Source Biosciences on the front end, so the actual gene analysis, so they're doing that part of it for us. We're collaborating with partners in Oslo on the DNA cancer DNA platform, and then we have collaborations, academic collaborations in Birmingham, Oxford, around the validation, and that's important. One of the big challenges, not just for startups actually, is getting hold of good annotated clinical samples that we can use to evidence our assumptions around new types of platform. And so we have a number of collaborations to ensure that we've got a really strong validation behind our new platforms going out there. And again, that was a reason, as I mentioned, why we're working with MBM in China, because they've got that local knowledge and capability.
Excellent. And David, what do you do to relax when you're not busy moving the frontiers of cancer research?
Well, I try and to set an example. So I'm very involved in triathlon as a coach, but also as a competitor. And I find that a great sport to just be able to find the time to do stuff. People often say, how did you find the time to train? So take this morning, I know the traffic. I live in Cheltenham, and the traffic around Oxford is horrendous. So I just get up that bit earlier, get into Oxford in good time, jog down to the pool, do a swim, and I'm back in the office for 8:30. So rather than sitting in traffic for that extra 40 minutes, I've got to swim in. So, you know, competing in triathlon is a good one, actually.
Excellent. David, thanks so much for your insights on a fascinating startup, the change of business models within this sector, and the contrast on that with corporates. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Andrew.